Welcome to South Fork Law. My name is Paula McCandless and my co-host is Jill Bernstein. I'm an attorney practicing law with the law firm of Brett McCandless Brown. We help people who have been injured through no fault of their own, and we help family members who have lost a loved one due to another party's negligence. My co-host Jill Bernstein is a retired criminal defense attorney. Jill and I are eager to talk about the law and legal issues. We want to share and explore stories from our legal community and discuss justice and the law. Tonight's guest is with the Washington State Bar Association. He is the Chief Disciplinary Counsel and Director of the Office of Disciplinary Matters, Doug Ende. Welcome.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
Well, Doug, we're really excited to have you as a guest this evening. And I think what Paula said, your title is sort of a mouthful, but basically you help to police the lawyers. Is that right? To make sure that they're ethical and that they're following the rules that govern the profession.
Yeah, in some sense, that is quite correct. The Supreme Court of the state of Washington, which is responsible for regulation of the practice of law in our state, enacts rules of ethics, the rules of professional conduct, and rules of disciplinary procedure. And in the Office of Disciplinary Counsel, we exercise delegated authority from the Supreme Court to review and investigate allegations of misconduct and make recommendations with respect to potential disciplinary action.
Well, before we dig into that, because I really, even though it sounds very abstract, it really is at the heart of the profession, keeping people on the right track and making sure that lawyers are honoring their profession, their clients, and doing the work that they're supposed to do. But before we go into that, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you find yourself with the law, with a legal career?
I'll say it was not the adversarial aspects of the profession or even the dispute resolution function of law that really interested me initially. In a sense, it was the legislative aspects of law, positive law, the creation of law that I found really interesting and drew me to it. And by that I mean the compulsion or obsession with specificity or exactness in expression of ideas. So if you think about a legislative enactment or even a court rule, you always find it starting with a definition section because it's trying to be as specific as possible in terms of what it is trying to regulate or govern. So you might have a definition of automobile or horse, and it will say exactly by horse. In this context, we mean exactly this. And it might also say we don't mean X, Y, and Z, because in law it's important to the regulated to know exactly what is permitted and what is prohibited. And it was that kind of thinking that I thought I could usefully contribute to. I feel a little bad that my first response isn't, I wanted to help people. Because certainly I did want to help people.
Well,
and a lot of people say that, and it's great. I'm so glad that people want to help people. But many, many professions, many callings are about helping people. And if I wanted to help people, I could have become a nurse or a clergy person, or probably you ask almost anyone who's out in the workforce, are you helping people by what you're doing? You ask an architect, they'll say, yeah, I'm helping people, but I wanted to find a way to help people that would be a good fit for the way I think. And law seemed to be that for me. I picked up and headed west and landed in Seattle, and that's where I went to law school. I attended the University of Washington School of Law.
My response was going to be a little bit different than Paula's about your description of you and the law. I think it's downright quirky that you thought this was a place for a person who loves language. And but it sounds like that's really what attracted you to law.
Yeah, very, very much so. I'm a reader. I'm a writer. And I I have to confess, when I was at the undergraduate institution from which I graduated, I was majoring in psychology, and I really thought ultimately I would pursue a career in research psychology or perhaps clinical psychology. But late in my studies there, I think it was my junior year, I began engaging with some of the faculty there who were doing research in the area of law and psychology. And by way of example, they were researching the reliability of eyewitness testimony. And the more I worked in that part, that subfield of experimental psychology, and the more I read and wrote about it, the more I realized that it's really the law part of this that I'm finding interesting, much more so than the experimental psychology side of things, and that really motivated me to seriously consider law school.
So you graduate from law school. What happens next? Where do you work? What do you do?
Well, I'll put it this way. My path to the Washington State Bar Association and the Office of Disciplinary Counsel was not a straight line. I wasn't exactly careening from position to position. But I don't think anyone in law school thinks, I want to do discipline work. I want to discipline lawyers and embark on a career in that. Because you don't even know, you don't necessarily think that that's a field of endeavor. So it certainly never occurred to me, although now when I speak in law school classes, professional responsibility classes, I do point out that there are indeed opportunities to work in the field of legal ethics, if that's an interest. But for me, I pursued a much more traditional, perhaps, path coming out of law school. I worked at a litigation firm in Seattle. And what else did I do?
Well, I think
this is not necessarily in order, but I did all of the following things. I had a judicial clerkship at Division I of the Court of Appeals. I was a public defender for a time. It was an appellate defense, felony appellate defense. I worked with a small law firm doing criminal defense and appeals, very small firm. I taught legal research and writing at the University of Washington at the law school for 3 years. And after that sequence of very interesting and worthwhile positions in the law, I found myself as a starting disciplinary counsel here in the Office of Disciplinary.
All right, so basically you're the cop, right? You are checking to see for violations, and then you are also the judge and the jury, huh, to punish?
No, we're certainly not the judge and the jury, and that's probably an important point of emphasis. And I don't think the Office of Disciplinary Counsel lawyers and staff think of themselves as cops exactly. We have a very specific delegated duties that are set forth in an elaborate set of procedural rules.
So how does a case begin in your office? Who, somebody is upset with their lawyer, and then what happens?
That's one way a grievance can commence. Someone is irritated with a lawyer and files a complaint, which we call, under our rules, grievances. And grievances come in a number of forms. They do have to be in writing, so we receive a high volume of mailed in grievances, but they can also be submitted electronically through a portal on the Washington State Bar Association website. Now, once a grievance does come in, there is an intake unit within the Office of Disciplinary Counsel, and the responsibility of that group is to receive, docket all the incoming grievances and make preliminary decisions about whether they should be the intake phase or whether a lawyer's response should be requested.
Aren't the vast majority of grievances dismissed right at the intake phase?
A great many grievances are dismissed at the intake stage, absolutely.
So what are the complaints? What kind of complaints are people making about lawyers?
Give us the number one complaint.
The most common complaints fall into the category of not what we would call non-performance. And sometimes it's hard to pull apart allegations, but they tend to be alleging that the lawyer didn't do the work properly, didn't do the work fast enough, or wasn't communicating with me about what was going on.
So non-return phone calls would be up there in the top five?
Absolutely, and I would say it's generally more than not returning a phone call, but a pattern of non-responsiveness is something that really irritates an individual who has engaged a lawyer to solve a problem. And it's really no different, if you think about it, than any of us who are using consumer services, be it banking or credit cards or airlines. If you feel you're not being treated properly, you're going to want to take some action to bring that to someone's attention. And when lawyers' clients feel that way, one of the places they'll express the dissatisfaction is with the Office of Disciplinary Counsel.
Well, you were saying that most of these grievances that come into the office, whether they're in the form of a letter or through the website, are dismissed. So what would get something dismissed before you're even asking for a response from a lawyer? What do those complaints look like?
Well, it's important to bear in mind when you think about the disciplinary authority of the Supreme Court and the Office of Disciplinary Counsel that there's only one basis for a lawyer to be disciplined under the rules, and that thesis is a violation of the rules of professional conduct. And that violation would have to be proved by the Office of Disciplinary Counsel by a clear preponderance of the evidence. There's a high burden of proof to that. And if we receive a grievance that under no rational or conceivable set of circumstances is expressing frustration or dissatisfaction, but not a violation of the rules of professional conduct, nothing unethical, then those are the kinds of grievances that will tend to get dismissed without the lawyer's response being requested.
So, Doug, like what?
Well, let me give you a simple example. Let's say a lawyer is rude to another individual in the hallway of a courtroom.
I think Jill's pointing to herself.
Let's say that lawyer uses coarse language with another individual in the hallway of a courtroom. Now, we don't condone rude behavior on the part of lawyers. We're not pleased when we hear that, but at the same time, that in general, except in the most extreme for egregious cases, but in general, is not going to be a provable violation of the rules of professional conduct, which don't prohibit garden variety rudeness.
But I had a case where a client family came in to see me with the client, and then the neighbor came too. And apparently the best I remembered is the neighbor was trying to offer me advice about how to manage the case, and I wasn't perfectly pleasant as I told the neighbor that I wasn't that interested in her theory of how the case should go forward. And she filed a complaint against me, and you guys wrote me back and said I should try to be nicer.
Well, first of all, Jill, you know I'm not going to comment on a
situation. It's old. It's old. It's long ago. It's long ago.
I'm not going to say a word about that.
Yeah.
But hypothetically, should such a case occur, I think the ultimate outcome is going to be that grievance is going to be dismissed, even if there is language in the dismissal letter saying something like, you know, we don't condone rude behavior as part of licensees.
I took it in the spirit it was given. I should be nicer, and I have tried to be nicer.
It seems like almost it's misleading. It's called the Rules of Professional Conduct, and yet you don't seem to really define what professional is in the rules, if you can swear and not have appropriate demeanor.
Well, what is ethical and unethical is ultimately a decision of the Supreme Court when they enact rules to govern the profession, and I think that's what professional means in that context. Professional conduct means the conduct of the profession.
You know, what I think about is the way that lawyers get in trouble has to do with theft. A lawyer who is not running their business well, who misuses the funds that come in the office, takes fees and doesn't do the work is one thing you were talking about, but then just outright steals from clients. Do you see a lot of that?
Well, those types of allegations are the allegations that are going to move probably pretty quickly out of the intake unit and into an investigation posture, because dishonesty, theft, criminal conduct really strikes at the heart of the values of the profession that are reflected in the ethical rules. And so those cases, those allegations, if it turns out they're meritorious and can be proved, are taken seriously, and certainly they're plenty of cases out there, disciplinary dispositions, where lawyers have been disciplined for taking money and not providing services, or even more egregious situations.
What about the forgetful attorney, the one who forgets to renew their bar membership and pay their fees or report their continuing legal education? Do you see many of those?
So I need to distinguish very clearly between the licensing process, the annual licensing process, and it certainly is a regulatory requirement that to have the license renewed, a lawyer has to pay the annual licensing fee, must comply with continuing legal education requirements and other aspects of the regulatory scheme, but failing to do so is not a disciplinary violation. Those do not come through the Office of Disciplinary Counsel.
Well,
those are considered administrative issues that can result in extreme cases in a lawyer's temporary suspension from the practice of law, but those are administrative suspensions. Those are not disciplinary.
Well, I bet the next class of cases that you see a lot of have to do with sex, though. Lawyers having sex with their clients and forming inappropriate personal relationships with parties in their cases.
There is absolutely some of that, and you can read all about it in some of the reported decisions. Now, sex with clients is expressly prohibited in the rules of professional conduct. There is a very clear prohibition on having sexual relations with a current client.
Well, so sex with a client is bad. Sex with another party in the case isn't very good either. And so you see those cases. How about just lies? Lying to the judge, lying to another lawyer, a provable lie. That gets lawyers into trouble too, doesn't it?
Yeah, dishonesty is prohibited in a number of the rules of professional conduct. It is a core professional value, obviously. And it's prohibited both when a lawyer is acting as an advocate before a tribunal, and that's in the Title III Rules of Professional Conduct, and it's prohibited generally. Rule 8.4C makes it professional misconduct for a lawyer. engage in an act of dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation.
Now, Doug, do you sit with the rule book right next to you, or do you just have all these rules memorized by now?
I do sit with a rule book right next to me. And in fact, it's become a bit of a humorous anecdote in the halls of the Washington State Bar Association that I'm never seen without my dog-eared copy of the Washington Court Rules. But in truth, I don't know where I set that book down. I should have it open in front of me, but I do have quite a few of those rules.
Well, you're doing a marvelous job of you're quoting chapter and verse for us beautifully today. But before we finish, I want you to take a moment, please, and tell our listeners, what's the difference between an unskilled or bad lawyer and an unethical lawyer?
You know, that's a great question, and we probably don't have enough time to explore the contours of the difference between something that's unethical and something that's a mere mistake. And that is actually often in disciplinary proceedings a point of contention, whether something was a pure mistake that does not rise to the level of an ethical transgression, or if it is provable misconduct. I would say, by and large, obviously, we're all human, and we all make mistakes, and not all of those mistakes are violations of the rules of professional conduct. But by the same token, the rules of professional conduct, literally the first rule in the book, requires competence on the part of a legal professional. A lawyer shall provide competent representation to a client. Easy to say, and perhaps has different meanings in different contexts. But if a lawyer's performance falls below that basic duty of competence, and it's provable, then it can be a violation of that very basic responsibility, Rule 1.1 of the RPC.
Let me ask you, Doug, about the attorney hotline.
Yes.
If there's an ethics hotline that attorneys can use if they have a question. They're just not sure if what they're doing or what someone else is doing is maybe ethical. Could you tell us how the hotline works?
I can, and I'm glad you asked about the ethics hotline. First and foremost, it's important to emphasize that the ethics hotline is not a function of the Office of Disciplinary Counsel. So when a member calls the ethics line, they are not speaking to disciplinary counsel, and they can speak to the individual who staffs the ethics line. Is called Professional Responsibility Counsel. She does an excellent job. Her name is Jean Marie Clavier, and she works out of the Office of General Counsel at the Bar Association, and she's been answering ethics calls for a long time. And it is confidential, and Professional Responsibility Counsel will hear the ethical dilemma, assuming it's a question about the lawyer's proposed future conduct, and provide some guidance and walk through the applicable rules of professional conduct, and hopefully help the lawyer to make a correct and ethical decision. The number of the ethics line is 206-727-8284.
So, Doug, when you we've been talking about all the sins of that lawyers commit. They lie. They have sex with their clients. They don't do what they say they were going to do, and they're just not
there.
They steal, and they're not very good at their jobs. But let's phrase this in the reverse. What are the core professional characteristics that should be reflected in the daily work of all legal professionals? What should people look for in a lawyer?
Well, in answering that question, I want to start by saying, well, our stock in trade, it sometimes seems, is lawyers who are committing misconduct, lawyers who are not being honest, lawyers who are not delivering the services that they agreed to provide. That's a very, very small fraction of the profession. By and large, the practicing bar in the state of Washington is they're regulating their conduct appropriately. highlight the minority of individuals whose conduct rises to the level of an ethical transgression. So that said, your question is really about the key value, the core value that should underlie the work of all practicing legal professionals. And I would say I would boil it down to what I would call truth-telling. You might call it candor. You might call it honesty. And in my long view, having done this work for 20 years now, much of what clients expect and much of what goes wrong when lawyers cross the line into unethical misconduct ultimately can be traced back to a problem with honesty. And maybe my view is a perspective that derives from my days at the undergraduate institution that I mentioned. The motto is Veritas Vos Liber Obit, which I may not be pronouncing in accordance with classical Latin, but its meaning is the truth will set you free. Now, that probably had, back in the day, a non-secular meaning, but because this institution was very much a secular research institution, that's how I took it. That means that the truth is the way to achieve appropriate outcomes and goals.
All right, so let's,
and I found that to be true in the practice of law as well.
So let's take us from Latin, which, by the way, that is a great motto for all of us, professionals and non-professionals, to move forward. But I think one of the other things you've done in your life is you've written poetry that found itself on the metro buses in Seattle. Can you give us just a hint as to what that poetry was about? Can you quote a little bit for us?
You know, it was a long time ago. There would be a call for poetry, and bus rider poets could write poetry and submit it to a panel, a jury, that would determine which poetry went onto the buses the following year. So I really enjoyed reading the poetry on the buses. It made a difference in my daily commute. And I thought, well, I'm very much an amateur when it comes to reading and writing poetry, but I do enjoy it. So I thought, I'll try my hand at this. And I submitted a poem, and it wasn't accepted. And I tried again the following year. And to my great surprise, it was accepted. And so for about a year, a placard was up with my poem and my name on it. And I got more calls than you would expect from friends and colleagues and acquaintances saying, hey, I saw your poetry on the bus. What the heck did that mean? And it was a fairly dreamy and metaphorical poem, because I think in my poetic life, such as it is, I explore the opposite of what it is I love about the law, which is what I call the obsession with specificity. And I could allow myself to go in the opposite direction and create something that was very metaphorical and perhaps a little obscure.
Well, Doug,
I commend it to you. You can find it on the internet, but I can't recite it line by line like I can the rules of professional conduct.
Well, Doug, this conversation has taken us some pretty interesting places this evening, and I'm really grateful to you for making time for us and allowing us to know a little bit more about you and about your work. We are really happy that you could be our guest on South Fork Law. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
Jill and Paul, it's been a pleasure to be here. Can I make a closing remark?
Sure.
My closing remark is that anything I said today in our conversation has to be taken as my personal opinion only and not necessarily the position of the Washington State Bar Association.
We'll make sure that gets included. And it's been a delightful conversation. Thank you, Doug.
Have a great evening. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks to you both.
Bye-bye.
Bye.